Thank you very much for that introduction. I have to say that my resume sounds much better in French than it does in English. It's more impressive in French than it is in English. These last few days have not been very good ones for Anglo-European relationships, but I'm delighted to be here in Paris, and I very much hope that whatever the politicians say to each other, that we can continue to collaborate as academics and as scientists. We face a large number of challenges, and those to do with food security consist of three. One is the repeated food price spikes. Second, the fact that we've got about 1 billion people in the world who are chronically hungry. And thirdly, we've got to increase food production by 2050 by about 70 to 100%. These are formidable challenges. Those are the food price spikes, and you can see that the first one, 2007-08, went up and then came down, and everybody said, well, that's what you expect with a food price spike, no need to worry. And we're now in the middle of a second spike, which is not coming down very much at all. And one of the problems with these food price spikes is that the price in developing countries of food stays up. And so one of the consequences is civil unrest. It was a factor at the beginning of the Arab Spring. Not a big factor, but it was there as a factor. The Global Hunger Index measures hunger. It's a combination of FAO's measurement of hunger and child mortality. And as you can see, it's in Africa where the biggest concentrations of hunger are, although there's a great deal in South Asia. Underlying the spike is a chronic crisis, which is getting worse. The drivers are rising populations, rising per capita incomes, growing demand for livestock products, rising fuel and fertilizer prices, growing demand for biofuels, increasing water and land scarcity, climate change, slowing of productivity increases. Each one of those is worthy of a lecture on its own, but you're not going to get it. Perhaps most significant are the effects of climate change. These figure on the left there shows the areas of reduction in growing season in Africa. I was in Ghana last week, up in the north, and there the growing season is normally erratic, normally variable. But when you talk to the farmers, they say it's getting worse. It's even more variable than it was before. And this year, the growing season was shorter by a month at the beginning. The rains came a month late, and they finished a month early. So it was only 100 days in which you could get a rice crop. You can't prove that that's a consequence of climate change, but it's the kind of effect that the models will suggest is going to happen. The graph on the right shows temperatures above 30 degrees centigrade, maximum temperatures. And we know that if you grow maize, the yield drops for every day above 30 degrees centigrade. And of course, we have extreme events. This was the 2010, the heat wave in Russia and the floods in Pakistan, both linked by the same climatic phenomenon. Again, you can't prove this is a consequence of climate change, but it's what you expect to happen. So how do we begin to tackle these problems? I'm going to start by, in a sense, a personal history. I trained as an ecologist, and for me, what was fascinating was this small piece of turf with this incredible concentration and variety of plants and animals, insects and microbes. That picture embodies biodiversity. My first job was in North Borneo, and that was the view from my garden, and I've shown it simply out of nostalgia, whether you like it or not. That's Mount Kinabalu, which is 13,000 feet above sea level, and my house was at sea level. But when I first arrived there, I was told to go down to the southeast of the country, to the Indonesian border, where the cocoa was being attacked by numerous pests. So down there in this corner here, this was a large area of cocoa being grown. And when I went there, this is what I saw. The cocoa was bare of leaves, and there were all kinds of pests eating the leaves, eating the branches, eating the trunks themselves. A bagworm in the top left, a bug at the top right, a borer on the left here, a borer that cleverly circled the tree, ate all the outside. So the tree died. Just one caterpillar on one tree would kill the whole tree. Kind of clever caterpillar. And I said to the farmers, what are you doing? And they said, oh, we're doing a tremendous amount. We're spraying like crazy. We're spraying every week. And we're spraying with cocktails. We're putting DDT and endrin and dieldrin and heptachlor in a big mixture and spraying it. And you can see what they were doing, all those sprays in 1961 and 62. And I said, let's think about this. The cocoa plants were growing under the relics of the primary forest, and there were also many secondary forest trees there. And I said, maybe, naturally, the pests are being controlled by their natural enemies, which are in the forest. Maybe if we stop spraying, the pests will disappear. Well, of course, the farmers thought I was crazy. They said, what do you know? You know, you're only, 21 or 22 or whatever age I was. You don't know anything. You've got a university degree, but what's that? We've been here for years growing cocoa. But fortunately, I had a director of agriculture who said, I think you're right. We'll stop it. And so we stopped all the spraying. And the parasites and predators started to appear. Bottom left is a ichneumon parasite. Bottom right is another parasite attacking the pest at the top of the picture. And if you look at the graph at the top there, you'll see that after 6 months, all the pests disappeared, except for one, the bagworms, that continued. And there I chose a selective insecticide, one that would only kill the bagworms, and we sprayed with that. And by the end of 63, it had disappeared. This was an example of what is known as integrated pest management, IPM, which had only really been developed about 5 years earlier in California and Peru. And this was the first example outside of those places. And it was highly successful. The whole point about integrated pest management is that you try and not rely on one form of control. You rely on different forms of control, which you integrate in an ecological fashion. And of course, what you're using here is biodiversity. You're using the diversity in the natural environment of pest predators and parasites that eat the pests. And it persisted for something like three decades without any more spraying. Now, as soon as I'd done this, I went to the Philippines, to the International Rice Research Institute in the Philippines, to see what they were doing. I discovered to my horror that they were covering the rice fields with pesticides. What they were doing was putting the pesticides in a can and putting the can where the water flows into each field. So the water would come down the hillsides, flow through a pesticide one after the other down into the fields, filling them with pesticide. And I said, you're going to get problems. You're going to get pests. And they said, don't be silly. You don't know what you're talking about. And I said, well, I do actually. I've just come here from Borneo where that's what happened on the cocoa. But they ignored it. And in the 1970s, there came a big outbreak of what's called brown planthopper. You see them on the bottom left here. They suck the leaves, they cause hopper burn, and they carry viruses. And there was some brilliant research by a man called Peter Kenmore and others that showed that they also were being naturally controlled by enemies, by parasites, and also by wolf spiders there. And the problem was that the pesticides were killing the wolf spiders. Another example of the role of diversity. And so what they did was to, first of all, ban broad-spectrum insecticides, and they set up farm field schools where you could teach farmers about the hoppers and the parasites and the predators. And they learned how to count them in the field. And when the hoppers got above a certain threshold, then they could spray, but not before. And they only had to spray with a selective insecticide. And it worked. It meant that the number of sprays went down from 4, 5, 6, 8 per season down to 1 or 2. But in 2004, these hoppers all came back again. The problem was that the marketing of the new hybrid, that's not races, but rices, the new hybrid rices, didn't bring in enough money. If you sell seed, you don't make much profit. But if you sell pesticides, you make a lot of profit. So the sellers were combining the seed, often the new hybrid rice seeds from China, with the pesticides. They were selling them as packages. And so the farmers were really being forced into using the pesticides. And there wasn't the money for the IPM and the farmer training because it had been forgotten. They'd had, you know, over a decade or more, or 3 decades actually, of IPM working. And there's a big conference occurring in Vietnam this Friday on the 16th, in which they've got politicians and scientists coming together to find a solution to this problem now. So, those are examples of why biodiversity is important for food production. You need that diversity if you're going to control pests. It's just one example. What is important is to look at agriculture in terms of agroecosystems, which I define not just ecological systems, but also socioeconomic systems that produce food or fiber or other agricultural products. This is northern Thailand. Each of those fields is an agroecosystem, full of ecological diversity. It's not just water and rice. Just to emphasize the human part of it, this is one of my wife's paintings of a rice field that's hanging in New York. If you look closely at a rice field, what you see are these little ferns over here. Little tiny ferns floating on the water, called azolla. And they have cavities in the leaves. And in the leaves, in those cavities, are blue-green algae. And the blue-green algae take in 400 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year. And that goes into the rice fields. And you can get an extra ton per hectare from using them. Another example of natural biodiversity which helps in food production. And of course, in soils is an incredible diversity of microbes. I mean, a single handful of soil contains thousands of different kinds of microbe. Many of them very highly specialized. Each microbe works on a particular piece of substrate or on a particular piece of decaying matter. So what you have is an agroecosystem that looks a bit like this. In the center, the rice, with fish and weeds and competition between them. At the top, the microorganisms. At the bottom, the natural enemies. It's simpler than a natural ecosystem, but it still contains ecological processes, the processes of predation, of herbivory, of competition. On top of that, we lay human intervention. We cultivate, we harvest, we control the pests, we subsidize with nutrients, we control the irrigation. And we, in turn, the farmers, cooperate and compete. So you've got a genuine integration of people and ecological diversity working with each other. And if they do work together, then you've got a stable, productive system. These agroecosystems have got properties, and we've defined these properties as four. First of all, productivity. So if you think of the agricultural product, it can be high or low. You think of the trajectory of that product, it can be highly stable or very unstable. It can also be resilient. In other words, it can withstand stress or shock. And it can also be equitable. The products can be evenly shared or unevenly shared. And what is interesting about these properties is that they trade off with one another. It's very, very difficult to get high productivity, high stability, high resilience, and high equity. You often lose one or the other in the process. The Romans, for example, farming round here, produced not very high yields, about a ton per hectare of grain. But it was very stable, very resilient. Roman agriculture lasted 400 or 500 years. It wasn't particularly equitable, of course, because much of it was based on slave labour. But the point is I'm trying to make is that there are trade-offs between these properties. And I would define sustainable agriculture as a situation in which you've got high productivity with high resilience, high equitability and high stability. In other words, that's what we're trying to get. We're trying to minimize those trade-offs to get in that little H in the center there. You can also call this sustainable intensification. Or here in France, you call it ecological intensification. It's essentially the same thing, that you are intensifying, but using ecological principles in a way that's sustainable. That's what we need in the world today. And in the 1990s, we had a small group under the CGIAR that came up with the idea of the doubly green revolution. And one of the key people in that was a Frenchman, Michel Griffon, who some of you will know his book on the doubly green revolution. Basically, what we were saying was that you have to repeat the successes of the Green Revolution, but in many diverse localities, and make sure that it's equitable, sustainable, and environmentally friendly. In other words, it's as effective as the Green Revolution, but more sound environmentally. To do this, we need appropriate technologies. What do I mean by appropriate? First of all, does it work? Is it productive? Secondly, does it add significant value? Third, is it stable and resilient? Fourth, is it equitable? Are there downsides? And what is the counterfactual? These are the kind of criteria you need to put if you want to judge an intervention, a technology in this case, but it can be any other kind of intervention. And so you can think of appropriate technologies being traditional, or intermediate, or conventional, or based on new technologies. Let me give you some examples. A traditional technology is the home garden, which is at its most developed in Java, where around the house, the farmer, usually a woman, is growing a whole range of trees, of fruits, of vegetables, of herbs, and so on. Extraordinarily diverse set of agriculture. You only have to look here at the absence of home gardens, this is in Ethiopia, to realize just how barren those villages are without that rich growth of crops of various kinds and herbs around the house. And to emphasize the point about agroecosystems also involving human beings, this in northern Thailand celebrates lives of farmers, top right, farmer doing weaving, and the bottom right, the sticky rice that's used as offerings to the Buddha, and the bottom left, cooking the rice. They grow in northern Thailand sticky rice or glutinous rice. Local varieties are used by the farmers and are selected for different qualities. And in fact, they've shown that with the local rices, they can counter diseases and pests such as the gall midge. In fact, there are no modern rices that are resistant to the gall midge, but their farmers have developed varieties that are. Then there are intermediate technologies, which come under the general heading of agroecology. IPM I've talked about, green manuring, silver pasture, conservation tillage, biological control, rotations, intercropping, agroforestry, all kinds of technologies that will give you good yields because they're based on ecological principles, even if they're using some kind of conventional approach as well. So here's an example of growing maize with a legume like soybean or groundnut. You grow two rows of maize, two rows of soybean. You'll get 5 tons of maize and 1 ton of soybean if you do that. And then there is the continued use of conventional technologies. We shouldn't throw away synthetic pesticides or synthetic fertilizers. We can still use them, but use them in a very precise fashion. This is an example developed in Niger, where the farmers use the top of a Coca-Cola bottle, put the fertilizer in there, and put that in the hole where you're going to plant the seed of the maize. That way you focus the fertilizer. You only lose a small fraction of what would be done if you were covering the whole field with fertilizer. Another example. This is controlling this terrible weed called Striga. It's the purple plant in the picture. It's a very beautiful plant, but it just shows you that beauty isn't everything. You can control this weed with a herbicide called imazapyr. But imazapyr also kills the maize. But what they've now done is to use tissue culture to produce a maize that's resistant to the imazapyr. So what you do is you take the seed and you dip it in the imazapyr, plant it in the ground, and as it grows, the imazapyr comes out of the plant and kills the striga. But again, you're using very, very small amounts of herbicide. You're not spraying it all across the fields. And finally, there is biotechnology. There are three kinds of technologies. Marker-aided selection, where you can identify where the gene is. Tissue culture, where you take embryos and grow them in a culture up into a fully mature plant. And recombinant DNA, genetic engineering, or GM, genetic modification, where you directly transfer genes from one place to another. And again, diversity is crucial. Tissue culture here, small, I think, bananas growing in tissue. In this case, a cross between the African species of rice on the right and the Asian species of rice on the left. It's very difficult to cross them, but using a culture, you can do it. The man who did it was this man, Monty Jones, who came to us at Rockefeller Foundation and said, I'm trying to cross these two and I can't get it to work. I take the embryo from the cross and I put it in a culture and it doesn't work. So we said, why don't you go to China? Find out what they would say. So we paid his airfare to China and he went to China and the Chinese said, oh, we think the answer is to put coconut oil in the culture. Put coconut oil in and it worked. So for the cost of an airfare to China, we got these magnificent new rices, which have the combination of both Asian and African rices. They're like the African rice, they smother all the weeds, and they're resistant to pests and diseases and to drought. And then as they grow up like an Asian rice, and they'll produce 3-4 tons per hectare without fertilizer. And many Asians, when they look at that picture, say, what are those Africans doing in that rice field? And I say, this isn't Asia, this is Uganda. And you can see the rich rice growing there. Marker-aided selection is based on the notion that there is an enormous variety of genes in crop plants, many of which we simply don't understand what they do. But you can begin to isolate them using marker-aided selection, particularly in this case, looking for genes that help to make plants resilient to drought. And you can characterize individual plants by their DNA. Monsanto, who we normally like to hate, but has produced that a chipper now, which means that every single maize seed that they plant has the top chipped out of it and analyzed for the DNA. So they can tell you the DNA of every single plant in their experiments. It's an extraordinary piece of technology. And of course, the point about genetic engineering is that although in many cases the genes you want are in the variety or the species that you're growing, and you just have to keep crossing them and crossing them and crossing them to get there, it takes you years to do it. They produced high-quality protein maize recently, but it took them 16 years of crossing before they got them. You could do it faster with genetic engineering, and you can also do it with genes that aren't present in the particular crop. And those are two examples, BT cotton in Burkina Faso in Africa, and down the bottom, BT cabbages, except that's a cabbage that hasn't got the BT gene in it, which has sort of been produced by a rather crazy architect. What happens is that you take the gene from the bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, which occurs everywhere in the soil. If you went outside here, you could get it in the soil. You take that gene, it produces a protein, cryprotein, that's toxic to the insect caterpillars. Organic farmers spray the bacterium But genetic engineers take the gene from the bacterium and put it into the cotton or the vegetable. It's not a perfect solution, in part because you get resistance. You get resistance to the gene in the same way as you get resistance to pesticides. And the answer really lies in making BT compatible with integrated pest management they talked about before. Another good example is golden rice. The gene for beta-carotene, which is the precursor of vitamin A, occurs in the leaves and stalks of rice, but not in the grain. To begin with, that gene was taken from daffodils, but now it's taken from maize, and the right-hand one is the latest form of golden rice, which has beta-carotene in it, which produces vitamin A, which when eaten by children, for example, increases their vitamin A and prevents enormous amounts of mortality. Most of our crops are deficient in diversity. That's partly because we're breeding them in a narrow way, but it's also because in many cases we're not utilising the great range of wild progenitors. So, for example, soybean, which was domesticated in China, moved to the United States, was taken to the United States, but only a relatively small sample of soybean was taken there. So that the huge range of soybean genes is not in the breeding program in the United States, and we need to get that back. We need, in particular, to establish large genetic banks in which we can keep genes of crop plants and relatives of crop plants. This is one, the big one in Svalbard, in Spitsbergen, off the northwest coast of Norway in the Arctic Circle. This is what it looks like underneath the ice. All the way along on the right there are sets of seeds from all around the world. And we need to use wild plants, in particular as, or wild crops if you like, as climate change develops. Here, for example, in the Atlas Mountains in Morocco, they can't grow enough barley to feed themselves because of the continuous drought. But what they're using are the oil from the trees, on the argan oil and the euphorbia honey, which they can make some income from to supplement the lack of barley. So there are many wild plants, many wild trees and bushes that can be used as climate change develops. Finally, I just want to say something about the diversity that farmers perceive. I've talked about diversity among pests and their natural enemies. I've talked about diversity in agroecosystems, for example, in blue-green algae, in microbes. I've talked about the diversity in the genomes of crop plants and their relatives. And now there's the diversity in cropping systems as a whole, which is part of a modern sustainable agriculture. We discovered, a man called Robert Chambers at Sussex and myself, we worked with farmers in the 1980s, and we discovered that farmers could very easily draw maps of their environment, of their village. In this case, we said to the farmers, here's some coloured chalk, why don't you make a little map of your village? And they produced a wonderful model of the village. You can see there's a little hill at the back, and the real hill is in the far distance. Or here, a group of farmers in Haryana in India, they said that their watershed was degrading. So we said, why don't you do a map of the watershed? And you can see in the bottom right there, they're drawing the watershed with different colored chalk. And they identified four different phases of degradation in the watershed, with the different colours, green being fine, yellow being worst, and red being intermediate. What was interesting about this diagram was that the argument that happened. On the left are the farmers, on the right is the conservator of forests in Haryana. So here you've got a very senior official in the government of Haryana sitting down arguing with the farmers, with the farmers being very vocal about their knowledge, which is of this area. So it's a technique which gets farmers to talk about their experience. Here another one using pebbles and seeds, a woman farmer in India plotting out the seasonal calendar. Each stone at the bottom is the month of the year, and the little lines of seeds describe the activities, whether it be weeding or sowing or whatever. What is also crucial is for livelihoods of poor people to be diverse. This is a woman in the Sundarbans of India. And she's got rice fields, which I haven't shown, but she's also growing a whole range of root crops of different kinds, which she sells in the village. Her husband, on the left there, is raising fish fry, which he also sells. On the right, he's got a little bicycle taxi that he rides around the town, taking goods or people. So they've got the rice, they've got the root crops, they've got the fish fry, they've got taxis. And as I was leaving, I looked up and I saw a solar panel on the roof. And I said, what's the solar panel for? And he looked at me and said, electricity. If you ask a lot of stupid questions in a village, you often get really quite good answers. And so I said, well, why do you want electricity? Light bulbs. Oh. Why do you want light bulbs? I want light bulbs so that the children do their homework in the evening. And the point, of course, here is that if the children do their homework, graduate out of school, they can get a job in the nearby small town of some kind or another. And when the next cyclone comes, and it did 2 years after I was there, when the next cyclone comes, they've got rice, they've got root crops, they've got the fish fry, they've got the bicycle, and maybe they've got a boy or a girl who's sending some money back from their job in the little town. Most of us here are used to the notion that two people live together with children and they work 9 to 5. Some of the most devastating situations in Britain and probably here have been when whole factories are closed down where both of the couple work in the same factory. And the income is completely lost. Most of us think of a 9 to 5 job or a single job. Poor people, by force of necessity, have to think of a multiplicity of livelihoods. We tend to think of that as a bad thing, but in fact, given what's happening with climate change, it's probably a good thing. I've covered all kinds of things in this. I think the core conclusions, and you can come up with others too, is that the biodiversity is essential for productivity, stability, resilience and equity. It helps find the trade-offs. Secondly, that you have to use all kinds of technologies depending upon whether they are appropriate or not, irrespective of their source. And the final point to make is there are no magic bullets. Thank you. If any of you want a copy of that book that was shown at the beginning, there are piles of them down here. They're free. I mean, they're virus-free too.
Thank you very much. Y a-t-il des questions de préférence en anglais, mais je propose de les traduire. Oui?
Okay, I just want to ask, because of your definition of the agroecosystem as an ecological and socio-economic system, so you told about Monsanto a lot of things, but you just told about biodiversity in the agro side, as to say. So what's the economic side of the thing? Because we all know there are a lot of lobbies which can have a big influence on all this process of of agriculture. So what could you say about this?
No, you're right. The if you start to think of an agroecosystem not just as a field, but you start to think of it as, say, a big agricultural system as a whole, then you don't just have ecology and agriculture and human sociology, you've also got economic pressures of different kinds. And there are an enormous number of those. You talked about the role of the big multinational companies in seed production, the big five or six, not all American, there are two are European, we need to remember. And they have a big influence. But there is also the big influence of trade and trade negotiations, the extent to which trade is unequal in the world. That's another huge factor. There is now in most of the developing world, the development of supermarket systems. So for example, supermarkets in Nairobi in Kenya are drawing vegetables in from outside and behaving just like supermarkets in France or Britain, controlling controlling the flows of produce. What needs to be done to counter some of those effects are the development of various kinds of cooperative programs, cooperative groups, which strengthen farmers' rights and strengthen farmers in their negotiations with the bigger companies and bigger producers. Not easy.
Are they really able to negotiate?
It depends. In some cases, yes, they do. And of course, that happens in the West. I mean, if you take somewhere like the Netherlands, for example, you have, for example, nearly all the milk production is through cooperative systems. You have things like the Rabobank in the Netherlands, which is a huge cooperative bank. And my guess is that the farmers in the Netherlands have got really considerable power in their negotiations with the processors and sellers. I'm looking at you, David, because I know that you may know about this, but it depends on how you set these up.
No, we learned from one of the previous speakers in this conference cycle that there is a reason why these huge companies develop that sell seed. It actually is apparently quite difficult to produce your seed locally. It is easier to buy it, you know. And so, we heard about some of the mischief that comes from that centralization of power over the diversity or lack thereof of seeds. Yes? Yep.
Who's got the microphone? Lady there.
First of all, thank you for your talk. I just want to say one of the previous speakers during the cycle of conferences also mentioned the Svalbard project, and he was rather critical of it for two reasons. The first being that these huge seed banks are maybe not viable on the long term because the seeds need to be brought out to germinate and then refrozen. And the second reason was he thought this was a very static idea of biodiversity and that a more useful way of using biodiversity and gene diversity would be to have a diversity of plants in the field as opposed to in a giant freeze. And I just wondered what your point of view was on those points.
Well, I think the simple answer is you need both. I mean, the Svalbard seed bank is meant to be a single seed bank with a duplicate of the seeds in individual countries' seed banks. So that if you have a particular country which has a terrible natural catastrophe, an earthquake or a tsunami or a war, for example, Iraq lost a lot of its seed bank, you've at least got duplicates in Svalbard and it's pretty secure. But you're right that the most important is to preserve the variety in situ, if you can. And there is a great deal of that work going on. I mean, I've got other slides in which I could show you that. The good example is that one from northern Thailand, where all the local varieties are being preserved because the farmers are preserving them and are themselves doing the breeding and selection. For example, there's a great deal of work being done on potatoes by Peruvian and Bolivian farmers using their local seeds. And all of that falls under the International Treaty on Crop Genetic Resources. And there is funding in that to do exactly what you're saying. You actually need both.
Yeah, thank you. I think everybody agrees that biodiversity is needed, a condition for survival. Talking about food, what do you think about food waste? Is there reducing food waste? Would it be a reservoir for extra food?
Well, yes, there is. Although I tend to, you've got to talk about two kinds of food waste. You've got to talk about the food waste in the industrialized countries, you know, where you go to a restaurant, you only eat half the food and it gets thrown away, or you open a packet and you only eat part of it and it's thrown away. That's enormous, the amount of food waste there. In developing countries, the big food waste is in storage. Far too often, the grain or whatever else is stored in a particular house or in a village, and it's attacked by pests and diseases, and a great deal of it is lost. If you can take the grain almost immediately from harvest, put it in bags that are well designed, and put it in a store which may be fumigated against pests if you need to, you will reduce the amount of waste there considerably. Also, of course, reducing the amount of pest attack will reduce the amount of waste. So there are different kinds of waste and different kinds of ways of tackling it. I don't really know how you tackle food waste in the developed countries. If anybody's got a workable solution to that, I'd be interested. One back there too.
Okay.
Oh, no, she's.
Okay.
We'll get to you.
Evening, sir. Thank you for your talk first. And you have mentioned the genetic technologies in your lecture, and I'd like to know what's your opinion about the genetic plants or crops. You know, there was many debates on the relationship between the genetic plants and the human being health.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I think it's very important to understand, I was trying to make that point, that genetically engineered plants, we will probably need them for particular reasons, not for particular purposes, not for every purpose. In many cases, we can solve the problem by conventional means. It's very difficult to solve the problem of lack of vitamin A in babies without genetically engineered rice. There are millions of of infants die each year because of lack of vitamin A in the rice. So that's one example where we're going to need it. But other cases, we don't need it. And you have to determine whether that's a good thing or not. What is interesting is that although here in Europe we mostly don't like genetically engineered crops and won't grow genetically engineered crops, in part because they don't seem to be very necessary. If you go to Africa, there are something like 7 or 8 African countries that are running field trials on genetically engineered crops. There's a wilt disease of bananas that's come down into Uganda and East Africa generally, that's decimating the bananas. It's a terrible disease. And they've got some genes that are resistant to it from Academia Sinica, from the Taiwanese Chinese Academy. And so they've donated the genes. And the bananas are being transformed in the government laboratories in Uganda. And they've got, as it were, in greenhouses at the moment, they've got bananas that are resistant to the wilt. Now, there seems to be no natural resistance to wilt. This works, and interestingly, it's being financed entirely with public money. This is nothing to do with Monsanto or Syngenta or BASF. This is purely public money, and it will be made available to growers in Uganda and elsewhere, either free or very cheaply. So it's got a role to play, but it's not the answer. It isn't a magic bullet, but it's got a role to play. Look, you mentioned the impact of health on health. From what I've read, there is no peer-reviewed literature that shows any impact on health of GM crops. And of course, we've been eating them for 15 years, or at any rate, the Americans have been eating them for 15 years. And we, all of us here in Europe, are eating livestock products which contain genetically modified soybean as their feed. We don't talk about it. Nobody talks about it. But even in Britain, probably half of the animal feed is GM soya. So we have a certain schizophrenia about GM.
If I may ask, there is another connection between the diversity of varieties of food and health. I'm not sure whether this is just coincidental or causal, but you know, one of the most spectacular kinds of reduction of diversity that I'm aware of is the one in maize that used to be, I mean, we all know that, well, in the United States we call it corn. You know, just for those who might know that word, but it's maïs in French. So maize or corn, the native populations of the southwest of what's now the United States and Mesoamerica used to have, I don't know, tens of varieties which had different colors. And actually this was part of the art of the Hopis and other populations. They were, artworks made with colors, just displays of these varieties of corn. Now, as you know, the stuff, you don't eat much in France, but you know, it's sort of well-liked in the United States to just eat corn with your barbecue and so on. Well, as far as I know, there's one variety, you know, maybe two. And I've also noticed, it just happens that my one of my uncles was an anthropologist who did his work on the southwestern populations of Native Americans, that there's an even larger incidence of obesity in those populations today than there is in the general population in the United States. And I wonder whether the fact that, you know, this vegetable has become less interesting than it used to be. I assume it also tasted differently. And so the fact that there's all this snacking and supermarket food has not also something to do with the lack of biodiversity.
Well, I think, you know, I think that may be true. I think it gets to be a complicated argument because we've got a great diversity of junk food. That doesn't necessarily mean that junk food is better because we've got a diversity of it. I mean, you're right about the great diversity of the maize. And if you go to Mexico, you'll see huge numbers of different forms of maize being grown by the Mexicans and the local villagers who maintain the ones they like, just like those sticky rices in northern Thailand that I described. And I think it's important that we preserve those. But more important, I think, is that you go back to crossing with those mazes to get the varieties that you're producing today to have got some of those constituents in them. And of course, there's been a huge amount of crossing with maize of different varieties. There are countless varieties of maize. The very early work on developing maize resistant to rust consisted of crossing some American mazes with mazes from Kenya. And that's how the whole process of the Green Revolution actually began. So there's some kinds of diversity that are good and some kinds that are bad, and I haven't really gone into that. I'm not sure even I know how you can identify good diversity from bad diversity. It all depends upon your objective. You had a question, but you got ignored.
So when you talk about sustainable agriculture, you said it should be at the intersection of productivity, stability, resilience, and equitability. And after you talk about GMOs, and do you think it's possible to get an equal system with the actual system of patents and big companies which control of the GMOs trade?
So you were saying, can you get an equitable agro-ecosystem, right? But particularly
with GMOs, because as big companies such as Monsanto and all that control all the seed trade, no. How would you get an equal system?
At the moment, you've got 10 million farmers in the world that grow GM crops, small farmers, less than 2 hectares. It's a huge number. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're bad for small farmers or for poor farmers. If you're getting a big yield as a result of planting that seed, then you become better off. I mean, I've seen farmers, forget about GM, just think about hybrid seeds, hybrid maize. It's not GM, but it's produced by big companies, also produced by governments. You can't tell whether the hybrid seed that you plant is produced by a government in Kenya, for example, or whether it's come from a Monsanto or from CIMMYT, the big International Center for Maize and Wheat Improvement. So the seeds come from all kinds of different sources. If you're growing your local maize, I was in Zambia just recently, growing your local maize, you get about 750 kilos per hectare of crop at the end. If you grow a new hybrid maize, you can get 7 tons per hectare. You just have to think about that, the difference between 750 kilos and 7 tons. It transforms your life. You may have to pay for the seed, but the amount you pay for the seed is just a simple fraction of the amount that you'd get back from that hybrid that you plant. That'll be true of any modern seed. It's just like, I don't know how many of you have got gardens. If you've got a garden, you want diversity and you want seeds that are certified, that germinate and produce what you want. And you go and buy it. You go and buy a packet of seed. It's only a small amount of money to buy the seed, a fraction. You get whatever it is you want. It is true that these big companies are powerful, but they're not as powerful as everybody makes them out to be. There's an enormous amount of government research going on. For example, the research in Britain on genetically modified potatoes to make them resistant to late blight is being done by government laboratories. Half of the GM research in Africa is being done by government. And in China, all the GM research, virtually all of it, is being done by the government. China's got something like 30, 40 different GM varieties being developed right now. Many of them are large-scale field trials. That's all from the government. It's not from the big companies. So it's not quite as simple as seeing it as
not just black and white. It's again in many hues, like that maze.
I'll remember.
Yeah, just building on what you said, if using GM maize, we increase tenfold the output of the crop, don't we exhaust the soil? And in such a case, this would be a short-term approach. For a few years, we get a huge output. And then what? We need to use fertilizers, or what do we do?
Of course, you can do it. With any seed, if it produces a big yield and you're not replacing the nutrients, that's what will happen. What I was describing in Zambia wasn't GM. I said that several times. It's hybrid maize, not GM maize, hybrid maize, produced by conventional means, right? And there it's being used in conservation farming, which is something I didn't describe here. But conservation farming means that instead of ploughing the land, you cut down the maize after you've harvested it and you leave the stalks and the leaves on the surface. You then make little holes in the ground as you go along. And you, when it comes to planting, you put a little bit of fertilizer and a little bit of manure in the hole and you put seed in there from the maize and the maize grows up. You can go on growing maize year after year. Where I live in Britain, I live in Sussex, on the Chalk Downs. The first farmers came there 3,500 BC. You can still see their fields, believe it or not. They've been growing wheat, barley on those hills for now 5,500 years. They're fertile soils. They're kept fertile. Yeah, without crop rotation. Well, in some cases they've got crop rotation lower down, but in many cases they've been growing them continuously. There's a famous experiment at Rothamsted where they've grown wheat continuously for 150 years. In some cases just with manure, in some cases with manure and fertilizers. If you need to keep the yields high, above a ton per hectare, you can get a ton per hectare without doing anything, forever. If you need to keep them high, then you do need some degree of fertilizer and so on. But nowhere near the amounts that are put on regularly in, say, France or Britain. We're talking in developing countries of just a few grams per hectare. You could do that. If you're careful, and if you use the right kind of fertilizer and the right kind of techniques. That's what sustainable intensification means, that you can get the high yields, but with, I've seen yields in Zimbabwe of 16 tons per hectare of maize, which is just phenomenal. I think that probably isn't in perpetuity. You had a question.
Thank you very much for your talk. Okay, in the beginning of your talk, you
you presented new challenge that we have to face. In particular, you talk about people being more hungry and angry. And I was wondering if you think, what is your point of view of, can we face this new challenge? Are we going to face this new challenge, even if we can? Because of course, I think there's a lot of political issue. And then you also clearly showed that we need biodiversity to face this challenge, but do we also need new ideas? And for young researchers, can you tell us about new ideas or new leads for research, for instance?
Okay. Well, there were several questions there. The importance, we have to place a great deal of importance on governance and political leadership. The countries that are doing well in Africa in terms of food security are those with good governance and good political leadership. The country that's done spectacularly well is Ghana. Ghana's already achieved the Millennium Development Goal. It has created a very good system of agricultural production in which you've got, by and large, non-corrupt negotiation. You've got good markets, you've got good information, you've got good extension service, good agriculture. You can provide farmers with good seeds. And that seems to work. We gave the World Food Prize to John Kufuor, who was the president of Ghana, in recognition of the leadership that had occurred in Ghana in creating food security. So once you get that right, you've got a good chance of getting good food security. I think that's the real answer. It's not about technologies. The technologies are there. It's about the systems you put in place. That's a whole separate lecture. Chapter, I've just written a second edition of the Doubly Green Revolution, which you can buy next summer. And in there, there's a chapter really about what's called the enabling environment. On research, I think we need research in all the different areas I talked about. We need research on indigenous systems of selection and breeding, such as the rice in northern Thailand, or the multicolored maize in Mexico, or the potatoes in Peru. Need much more research on what farmers are doing, how they're doing it. You'll be amazed. I mean, I've worked in northern Thailand for many years, and the woman who is the plant breeder there said to me, she got very excited one year when I went to talk to her. She said, you know, we've discovered how rice crosses. Because as you know, rice is self-pollinating, so it's only 1% or less where there's a cross. And they discovered in northern Thailand there's a tiny little bee that does the crossing, that will fertilize one rice plant from another. And it can only fly a little distance. So you can actually lay out your breeding plots in such a way that the bees do it all for you. They do the crossing and you know what you're getting from one place to another. So that's the result of research. Secondly, there's a huge amount of work to be done on agroecology. The shift in cultivation is a good example. When I described the shift in cultivation in Zambia, that's in an area of long fallow. When I said to the farmers, what do you do? They said, well, normally we cut down the trees and we grow crops for 2 or 3 years and then we let the trees grow back again for 10, 20, 30 years before we cut them down again. Now, the promise of conservation farming with these small amounts of fertilizer and using the leaves instead of plowing the soil is that that may be permanent, but we need to know that. We also need to know whether there are micronutrient deficiencies. In northern Thailand, the yields started going down year after year. And we tried to work out what it was. Eventually, we discovered it was boron deficiency. So quite unusual, in a sense. So there's a lot of research on agroecology. There's also a lot of research on how you can use conventional pesticides and conventional fertilizers, but in a much more precise, targeted way, so that you reduce the dependence on them, make them more selective. And finally, there is a need to look at biotechnology. By biotechnology, I don't just mean GM. I mean tissue culture and microarray selection. Tissue culture has got enormous possibilities. You could do all kinds of things in tissue culture. For example, you can cross somatic cells, strip away the wall of the cell and cross them and grow them. And nobody knows what on earth you'll get if you do that. I mean, that makes the potential horror stories of GM fade into insignificance. So with tissue culture, you can do a great deal. But we need to do that and to see what might happen or not. And much more on microarray selection, so that we can really precisely understand what genes do what. So you can identify the particular genes. There's a gene known as the chaperone gene that's been discovered, which enables a plant to recover rapidly from drought. Basically, what it does is that when the drought comes, when the stress comes, the protein becomes misfolded inside the cell. And this gene produces another protein that helps to make the protein refold better. And so the plant grows away really fast. There's all kinds of genes there which we simply don't understand, which have enormous properties. And knowing what they are, you can then use them in plant breeding, whether conventional or GM. And then you do need to understand when it is that GM is important. And you need to understand to what extent will GM crops produce any kind of consequences on the environment. To what extent will the genes move into wild plants? We know they will, but it's very rare. Is that enough of an agenda?
I don't need the microphone.
Okay, sorry. So, I miss the point. Why is double green double green? In what respect is it double green revolution? You see my understand the question? Or?
Yeah. The original word for green revolution was because you had fields of green, rich fields of green wheat and green rice and green maize. What you're trying to do with a doubly green revolution is produce that and an agriculture that's environmentally friendly, if you like, which is based on ecological principles. It's an ecological agriculture as well as being a productive agriculture. You're going with the grain of ecological processes, not against them. The IPM is a good example of that, the integrated pest management. And also, we came up with the word because we thought it sounded good in French. The Americans wanted super green, and we said, no, doublement vert sounded much more beautiful description. You have to ask Michel Griffon the same question.
Yes.
Thank you. Just listening to you, I feel that we are not getting rid of the insecticides and pesticides soon. And do you think that there is a way of not using those? Because it sounds reasonable to have micro quantities to grow, you know, in some areas, you know, crops and everything. But more and more studies are showing that it's not good for human health, and it's not good for the marine environments and different environments. So do you think that there is a way of getting rid of those chemicals?
Well, I think it is crucial to reduce the amount of insecticides we're using. You can do it in lots of different ways. One is, of course, you can do it by breeding resistance, whether it's conventional or GM. Cotton used to be the biggest user of insecticide. Something like a quarter of all the insecticides in the world were sprayed on cotton. But with GM cotton, it's become much less. So that's just one way of doing it. The other is to have much stricter regulations about what insecticides people can use. In other words, you need to ban certain insecticides because they cause damage. and you need to have much tighter regulations. And in fact, this meeting in Vietnam, in Hanoi on Friday, my intelligence is that they are going to come up with government regulations that are going to be much tighter on the use of insecticides. It's not that insecticides in themselves are bad, it's because they're used so badly. They're prophylactically sprayed over large areas without much thought or attention. And that's the biggest problem, actually. I think the other, what you have to also remember is the problem we've got with antibiotic resistance in human condition. And we've got enormous problems there because so many bugs are resistant to antibiotics now. And again, the answer to that is very tight control and very tight regulation. You won't get it otherwise.
I think it's also a problem of combining chemicals and it's the accumulation.
Problem of combining?
Combining all those chemicals together. I mean, even if it's micro quantities, the accumulation over time is not, I mean, we don't have enough, I mean, long-term studies, I guess, to know exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. We shouldn't be combining lots of different things. We should be only using one or two at most, and only when it's necessary. I think we've come to an end. Davis.
Just a short question. You mainly talked about food security and agriculture in developing countries. So I was just wondering, what would you say about the role of biodiversity in our part of the world? Do you think it would play an equally large role?
No, you have to understand, I spent all my life working in developing countries, really. And I know, I did do a degree in British agriculture, but I can't remember what I learned. I really don't. I look at the farm where I live in Sussex. I'm surrounded by farms. I have an old farm myself, but only the farmhouse and a small amount of land. Some farmers, I think, are doing a good job, particularly of rotations, and many farmers in Britain have got quite complicated rotations. I mean, rotations, 7-course rotations, for example. And that seems to be a way in which they preserve the fertility and, in particular, the structure of the soil. Around where I live, the worst offenders are farmers who grow turves for garden lawns. Right? They grow these turves. And of course, two things happen. One is when you dig it up, you dig up the soil as well. And so you can see the fields getting lower and lower and lower. And secondly, when you go and buy a turf for your garden, you don't want anything in it except grass. So what they do is they blanket them with herbicides. And I think that ought to be stopped, to be honest. And I think that's where things are going bad. But my sense is that there's a great deal of biodiversity in the breeding in Europe, and a great deal of diversity in the crop rotations. But that's purely my subjective. I looked out of Eurostar on the way here and thought, well, maybe that's a good field and maybe that's a bad field, but that was all I came to conclude. I can't help you with European agriculture, I'm sorry. You have to go to somebody else.
I can try to point you to an article that I had in the journal of the Club Alpin Français about mismanagement of essentially high-lying areas in France. And I just remembered because Gordon said something about looking out the train and being able to tell this is a good field, this is a bad field. It's a fascinating article by a geographer. I can totally find it and pass it along to you. You know, it's about what historically used to, how the land used to be husbanded and managed and what's happening to it now with ski slopes and, you know, resorts and all sorts of other things. Okay, any more questions? If not, I hope that Po is ready, and we'll thank very much our speaker again. Thank you.